We've been engaged in a study of the Church of Jesus Christ. This would have been an extremely dreary subject if what we had been studying were the Christian Church in the world today. But the subject of our study has been the biblical ideal of the Church, and that is an enthralling subject indeed. We've considered the origin of the Church, how it began, and the nature of the Church, what it is. We've also given thought to the three main functions of the members of the Church, towards God in worship, towards each other in fellowship, and towards the outside world in witness. Last time, we looked at the Church's tribulation. The fact that the Church is persecuted by the world, which, a tribulation which, according to Jesus Christ, it should expect to receive, and if the Church is true to its mission and its message, it will receive. Now today we come finally to the Church's destiny, which naturally follows its tribulation. Because the New Testament teaches repeatedly that suffering is the path to glory, and that if we suffer with Christ, we shall be glorified with him. What then is the Church's final destiny? I want to bring to you a profound and moving description of the Church as the people of God, found at the beginning of the third chapter of the Epistle to the Colossians. Colossians 3, verses 1 to 4. Let me read it to you. If you then be risen or raised with Christ, seek those things that are above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your affection or your mind on things above, not on things on the earth, because you died, and your life is hid with Christ in God. When Christ, who is our life, shall appear, then you also shall appear with him in glory. The first thing to notice about these remarkable words is the repetition, the almost monotonous repetition, of the words, with Christ. Look at the text again. Glance back to chapter 2, verse 20. If you died with Christ. Chapter 3, verse 1. If then you are raised with Christ. Verse 3. Your life is hid with Christ in God. And verse 4. When Christ shall appear, you also shall appear with him, with Christ in glory. Here is a reference, as I'm sure you will have noticed, to the four main events in the saving career of Jesus: his death, his resurrection, his ascension, and his coming again. And in each case, the event did not concern him alone. We are said to share it with him. Did he die? We have died with Christ. Has he been raised from the dead? We have been raised with him. Has he ascended into heaven? We too have ascended, and we live with Christ there. Is he going to appear? We shall appear with him in glory. Now this truth, if only we can lay hold of it, is absolutely fundamental to a proper understanding of what the Church is and what the Christian is. The Church is the Church of Jesus Christ. It cannot possibly be conceived apart from him. The Church belongs to Christ. The Church is one with Christ. Being a Christian, therefore, is not just having a polite respect for Jesus of Nazareth. It's a matter of enjoying a deep, personal, inward, spiritual union with him. So important is this that I think I must emphasize it further. If we are Christians, if we've been born again in Jesus Christ, we are united to Christ. We're united to him in his death and resurrection, which are past, in his hidden heavenly life, which is present, and in his glorious appearing, which is future. We're not spectators merely of these historical events. We are partakers in them, in their virtue and their power. It isn't just that we have in our minds seen Christ die and rise again, and that we've watched these events with detached objectivity. No, we have ourselves died with him, sharing the benefit of his death, and we've risen with him to enjoy the power of his resurrection. Again, it isn't just that we can look up to heaven and visualize Christ reigning, nor is it just that we can look on to the end and visualize Christ appearing. No, we already share in his heavenly life now, and we shall share in his final glory in the end. In other words, the death and resurrection, the present life and the future glory of Jesus Christ, are not just events that we view from a distance. They are vital personal experiences. Two past, one present, and one future in which we are privileged to share. Now all this, this union with Christ, is a sublime concept, far too little understood and far too little pondered on in the church today. Now, I'm concerned at the moment not so much with the past, with the death and resurrection of Christ, as with the present and the future. And I'll bring you two simple subjects this morning. First, the church's present condition. If we were to ask the man in the street what he thinks of the present condition of the church, I think I know the kind of answer that we should get. The present condition of the church, he might ask, why, it's pathetic, absolutely pathetic. It's divided and rent asunder. It's morally and theologically confused. It's weak and feeble. It cuts no ice in society. In fact, the church is steadily losing ground all over the world, and to all intents and purposes, the church is finished. It's a diminishing religious remnant in an increasingly secular society. That would be the opinion of the unbelieving man in the street about the present condition of the church, and he's quite right. On the surface, the visible church is weak and sickly. It is confused and divided and worldly. But this is a very superficial assessment. Supposing we'd asked the same question to the Apostle Paul, I think we would have got a very different answer. What's the present condition of the church, Paul? I think he would have replied, the present condition of the church is that its life is hid with Christ in God. Its life is hid with Christ in God. I think you'll agree that's a most extraordinary statement. The true life of the church, of the true believing people of God, the true life of the church is not visible, it's invisible. It's not apparent, it's hidden. It isn't among men on earth, it's with Christ in God. The true life of the church is hid with Christ in God. Oh, visibly, I know, on earth the church is in a sorry state, in a very sorry state indeed. But the church possesses a secret life that the world knows nothing of. In the nature of the case, the world cannot know anything of it, probably doesn't even suspect it exists. After all, no scientific instrument can examine it. This hidden life of the church can't be weighed, it can't be measured. It can scarcely be described to those who've never experienced it. But the true people of God, redeemed and regenerated by Jesus Christ, have a hidden life, a life of communion with God through Christ, a life that strengthens, invigorates, satisfies. They've shared the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. They've risen with him to newness of life, and they live, in a phrase characteristic of the Epistle to the Ephesians, in the heavenlies. A life hid with Christ in heaven, in God. How can I explain this to people who've never known it? Perhaps I could put it like this. A lover whose sweetheart is thousands of miles away in a distant country will certainly understand to some extent what I'm talking about. This lover lives in London, but he is in a real sense absent-minded, because his mind and heart are elsewhere with his beloved. Oh, he lives in London, but his heart and mind are across the ocean. Thither his thoughts continually fly. His life is there. His favorite songs are "My True Love Hath My Heart." His heart is where she is, not where he is. Or again, "My Bonnie Lies Over the Ocean." Perhaps it's not a very happy illustration, because a man in love is proverbially of very little use. He's so absent-minded that he's unable to concentrate on his daily work and duties. Not so the Christian. Don't imagine that to have your life hid with Christ in God means that we neglect our life on earth. No, no, on the contrary. The New Testament makes plain that the Christian's hidden and heavenly life enables him to live his earthly life all the better. And this very chapter in the Epistle to the Colossians includes practical instructions about the Christian's home and work, about his relations, the relations between husband and wife, parents and children, employers and employees. So you see, Christian people, which means the church, Christian people are a strange combination. A combination which is in fact an enigma to the world. They live on earth, but they dwell in heaven. They move among men, but they abide in God. Their everyday behavior is open and visible, yet their true life is hid with Christ in God. My friend to whom I'm speaking, let's test ourselves. How much of this hidden life have we? Some people, you know, display all their goods in the shop window. They keep nothing under the counter in reserve. They're shallow, superficial creatures with no hidden life at all. They're rather like a shallow pool, a puddle on the roadside, on whose bottom every littlest stone is clearly visible. There's nothing under the surface that you can't see. But then there are other people, surely you've met some, haven't you, who are like a deep, deep well, fed by some hidden spring. You peer down into it, but you can't see the bottom. There is about these people a mystery that you cannot fathom, a depth that you cannot plumb. Their life is hid with Christ in God. This is the church's present condition. This is the present condition of the true people of God who have experienced a new birth and risen with Christ. They are despised by men, but they're known and honored by God. They're persecuted on earth, but nourished by Christ. The church is apparently moribund with little hope of survival, and yet its life is hid with Christ in God. That's the first part of the subject that I wanted to bring to you today, the church's present life. Now, secondly, let us move on to the church's future destiny. If you were to ask an unbeliever about the destiny of the church, I think he'd be delighted to give you his opinion. The destiny of the church, he would say, well, it may survive for a few more decades. It might survive even for a few more generations. A minority of mentally unstable and emotionally insecure people will no doubt continue to find consolation in organized religion. But, they would go on, for a man come of age, a man who's graduated into the modern, scientific, technological age of the 1960s, why, the church is utterly redundant. Its destiny? The church is going to die a lingering death, they will say. All right, we do not deny some of these things. We do not deny that the church is involved in a life and death struggle with the world. We do not deny that the world is going to persecute the church, sometimes successfully, that it's going to stifle the church's witness and drive the church underground. We do not deny that in decades to come, the Church of Jesus Christ may very well have to spend time out in the wilderness. But, as the church has a present life that the world knows nothing of, so the church has a future destiny that the world knows nothing of either. Jesus said he was going to build his church on rock, not on shifting sand. He said that the gates of Hades, that is, the gates of death, would not prevail against it. In other words, the church has a certain destiny which is to be fulfilled beyond history, in eternity. Death cannot destroy the church. Let me bring you back to my text and to verse 4. When Christ, who is our life, shall appear, then shall you also appear with him in glory. One day, my friends, Jesus Christ is going to appear again. When he ascended up into heaven after 40 days since the resurrection, he disappeared from human view. But at the end of the age, he's going to reappear, personally and visibly. In his own words, you shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. Oh, I have no doubt that this event is going to transcend imagination. I've no doubt it is beyond description because it is beyond anything that we can conceive. All the same, it is not going to be less than, nor is it going to be essentially different from a personal, visible appearing of Jesus Christ when he shall appear. Now, when Christ shall appear, we're told by St. Paul, we shall appear with him in glory. It's so important that we should understand the contrast between verses 3 and 4. I wonder if you've already noticed it. It's a contrast between what is hidden and what is going to appear. Christ himself is at present hidden, but he's going to appear. Our present spiritual life is at present hidden, but it's going to appear. While Christ is hidden, we are hidden with him. But when he appears, we shall appear with him in glory. In glory. What does that mean? Well, glory in the New Testament is the outward visible manifestation of a thing's true and hidden nature. Many things are hidden, but their glory is when they appear. The glory is the visible manifestation of a thing's true and hidden nature. Now, Christ is going to appear in glory. That is, he's going to be seen as he is. And the church is going to appear with him in glory, because the church is going to be seen as it is. The true nature of the church, of the people of God, now hidden from view, is going to be plainly revealed for all men to see. Well, you may ask me, what is the true nature of the church that is now hidden and is going to appear? What is the glory of the church that is now veiled? Well, I'll tell you, it's just this, that the church, which men have despised, ridiculed, rejected, and persecuted, is the people of God. It is a community redeemed by Jesus Christ. The church is God's new creation, created in the image of Jesus Christ. That's true of all Christian people, all true Christian people. God's people have been recreated in the image of Christ. Now, this divine image in Christian people is veiled to some extent now, and the world doesn't recognize the children of God because their life is hid with Christ in God. But one day, on the last day, when he appears, we are going to appear with him. And our transformation into the image of Christ is going to be complete. As John wrote, we know that when he appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. Or as Paul wrote elsewhere, Jesus Christ is coming to be glorified in his saints. That is, the beauty of Christ is going to be seen in his people. They're going to be like mirrors reflecting his glory. Better still, they're going to be like gas mantles, incandescent with his light and glory. But please notice this, that the only glory of the people of God is Christ's glory. The glory of the church is the glory of Christ. And this is why the church's glory can only appear when he appears. Thus, the final destiny of the church, the people of God, is to be conformed, completely and eternally conformed, to the image of Christ. Well then, let me just recapitulate for a moment and then conclude. What we've considered today is the present condition and the future destiny of the church, the people of God. We've seen that their present life is hid with Christ in God, and that their future destiny is to be revealed with Christ in glory. These truths, these tremendous truths, once they've been thoroughly grasped and digested, will considerably adjust our perspective. They will add a new dimension to our lives. They'll give us a new set of values, a new direction, a new ambition, a new preoccupation in life. What is this? Well, look at verses 1 and 2. If you are risen with Christ, seek the things that are above, where Christ is, and where you are with Christ. Set your affection on things above, not on things on the earth. Do you see? Our new ambition is to seek the things above. Our new preoccupation is to set our mind upon things above. And if our heart and mind are set on things above, we shall not neglect our earthly duties. No, we shall do them all the better, with new zest and joy and purpose. But our heart and mind are going to be where our life is. Our life is with Christ in God, and our heart and mind will follow it there. Our heart and mind will be where Christ is, risen, seated, and reigning at the right hand of God.